what it is it's a reconstruction of a historical social network of people who lived in Britain from 1500 to 1700. People have been writing about social networks for a long time, and so we have been doing some text mining and sort of inferring statistically social mm-hmm. networks from the history of scholarship. And so that's given us a sort of probabilistic kind of best guess sense of who knew whom in early modern Britain. And then now we've just released a public website in which anybody, scholars, students, citizen humanists can come along and add to the site, add people to it, add relationships to it, to really sort of crowdsource the knowledge that is really the backbone for a lot of the work that people do in the humanities.
So can you tell me a little bit about the process, how you actually mine these data and, you know, made it into something that's easily searchable and navigable?
We started with something called the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography is kind of the gold standard of lives of people who lived in Britain really from the Roman Empire to the contemporary period. So what we did is we sort of took anybody who lived between 1500 and 1700, and we looked for how often names occurred together. So we started by asking, well, if this name is there, how likely is it that another name will be there as well? And it turns out that that actually gets us a really long way in determining who knew whom.
I mean, how much of it is just pure algorithmic brute force and how much of it is human curated?
Well, so the algorithmic brute force of it is pretty substantial. But this actually sort of gets us into a kind of an interesting problem, which is oftentimes there are some names that appear that don't actually say anything about whether two people knew one another.
Right.
So anybody who lived when Queen Elizabeth was queen, Queen Elizabeth's name probably appears in that dictionary entry. So we had to kind of develop sort of ways to disambiguate one person from another. Once we had a data set that sort of looked pretty good, and so when I say looked pretty good, it means that people sort of in the humanities like myself who were really used to sort of knowing actually in a limited way who knew whom, were sort of looking at these lists and saying, does this pass the laugh test? And, you know, in many cases it didn't. In many cases there were some sort of things where, like, there's no way these people knew one another. It's impossible. But as we sort of worked iteratively, there were many moments where we said, actually, this is starting to look really interesting. I'm not sure if these people knew one another, but wouldn't it be fascinating if they did?
That was kind of my next question. What is the utility of this to you as a humanist, as a literary scholar? How does this help you read these texts in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. So even at the kind of probabilistic level that we're talking about now, and I should emphasize that we're sort of moving to a much more sort of complete picture, but even at the probabilistic level, to me, it sort of opens up a world of possibilities for interpretations. So, you know, when I read a great poem by Milton, a great play by Shakespeare, one of the questions I often ask is, well, where's this idea come from? Where's this line come from? Is it possible that Shakespeare knew about this current event and there's a reference here to it? In order to try to answer those questions, you have to sort of think about the paths of ideas and language and the ways in which information flows through networks. In developing sort of a probabilistic model of who knew whom, we can sort of imagine new possibilities. Actually, maybe Shakespeare got this idea for this play because he had information stemming from, you know, this particular source at court. And that is actually the kind of thing that really is the bread and butter of historicist humanist scholarship, like the kind I do. So when you start sort of thinking about that on a sort of larger chronological sweep, larger geographic sweep, again, it's the kind of intellectual project is incredibly exciting. What would it be like to extend not only across the English Channel to France and Europe, but to think about the path of ideas and technologies from Asia, from Africa? It's a network world, even in the early modern period. It's just a kind of practical challenge of sort of bringing all that into the mix.
Why Francis Bacon? Is it just a cool name, or is he kind of really a central node in this social network?
Well, you know, a lot of people have heard of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Right.
Which of course comes from an earlier study going back actually to the 1920s and then sort of studied even more in the 1960s, the idea of 6 degrees of separation.
Right.
So here's the idea that any people are across the globe are connected by no more than 6 degrees. So, you know, it's true that we thought this was a good name, and we thought that 6 degrees of Francis Bacon was a good way to kind of get at the kind of questions of networks that really are at the heart of the project. It actually happens that Francis Bacon is a good node, and he is sort of at the center of both our chronological period and all kinds of other interesting dimensions of the early modern period. So a lot of people know Francis Bacon as the sort of founder of empirical method, which is sort of emerging at this time, and it's this kind of great scientific enlightenment over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries. Francis Bacon also is an important lawyer. He's involved in colonial projects like the Virginia Company. He's involved in mining projects. And so in some sense, once you actually sort of get past the joke, you get to all kinds of interesting things about early modern culture when you sort of study Francis Bacon. But it is true that it's not just about Francis Bacon. At the moment, there are 13,000 other people in the database, and you can search for any one of them and see their network as well.
Is there any potential difficulty in applying this concept of a social network, which I think we understand most of us in a particular way in 2015? Does that get in the way of what you're trying to do, or does that actually kind of make this approach more relatable?
A lot of people sort of come to the idea of social networks and think intuitively that they've been invented by Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. 6 degrees of Francis Bacon sort of challenges that, and I think in a kind of usefully provocative way. It's, I think, important that we look at our present moment with a sense of what's come before. And so when we think about social networks, online social networks, we can think what preceded them, and we can think about ways in which people knew one another and related to one another in different ways, in ways that are both fascinatingly similar and interestingly different from the sort of online world we now inhabit.
Talking to Professor Chris Warren of Carnegie Mellon University's English Department. Chris, thanks for coming by today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Josh.